Okay, so one duty of the last sort of senior speaker is to thank the organizers for a wonderful conference. I think it's been really, I've really enjoyed it as a fellow traveler. Maybe even people who are here enjoyed it even, and really in their own subject, enjoyed it even more. So I think we should give the organizers a big round of thanks. Okay, so as I briefly alluded to in my things I just said, I'm here kind of as a fellow traveler, maybe from a parallel universe or something. I think about modular forms, automorphic forms, data functions, and such things, and have all my life, but I'm not really an algebraic geometer, as you'll soon see from the talk. But what I wanted to try to do in this lecture was to make some point of contact between the theorems or some of the things I've been working on over the years and the subject of this conference. And I was furiously thinking about this in the back of the room, sort of not talk by talk, but sort of overall. And so you'll have to pardon the sort of amateurish aspects of it, which come closer to you. And anyway, we'll see how it goes. So what I want to do basically in an overview is I want to talk about some very old work that I did with John Milson about cycles in locally symmetric spaces, but particularly that I'll concentrate on the case of the algebraic cycles that arise in moduli spaces or in locally symmetric spaces, let me be careful, which are close to the subject of this conference. Then I want to specialize those results to the case of moduli spaces of K3 surfaces and lattice polarized K3 surfaces and see what they say in that particular case, sort of boiled down. Along the way, we'll see that there are various kind of problems that suggest themselves by analogy, some on my side of the game, maybe some on your side of the game. It'd be interesting to think about. And then with whatever we've accomplished so far at that point as background, I want to explain how to look at the sort of arithmetic version of these things and the what I call arithmetic special cycles. And so this will involve really looking at moduli spaces, but not over a C, but over spec Z or something as close to it as you can do. And in order to make that transition, as you'll see, I'm just outlining what the main steps in the talk will be. In order to make that transition, it will be very good to pass from the moduli space of K3 surfaces or the more general locally symmetric spaces I've been talking about and do the Kuga-Sasaki construction of abelian families of abelian varieties. And so then I'll need to make a translation between the modular interpretation of the special cycles a la K3 and the modular interpretation of special cycles a la Kuga-Sasaki. And once that's done, then you'll see how to make the arithmetic definition of special cycles, and then I can state some results and some conjectures about the arithmetic situation. So that's the outline of what will only take a few minutes. If all goes well, but longer if its reality strikes. So let me first begin by discussing my old work with Milson. So this is joint work with John Milson. And I checked this font from the back of the room, and I realize it's too small, but I figured that since there are lots of empty chairs, you know, if it really is too small for you, it's your fault. You can move forward. Okay, so I'm going to start with L, is with a bilinear form. This is a quadratic space or a lattice. Of signature N2, or let's do 2N here. I'm going to switch signs in the middle of the talk, but maybe I'll try to stick with 2N for a while anyway. Okay, so I'm going to start with a lattice with a quadratic form of signature N, 2N. I'm not assuming the unimodular or anything else. Right now, this is just such a lattice. And what I want to do is I want to, so let's let V be LQ, which is L tensor. With Q. So this is a corresponding rational vector space with quadratic form. And let's let D, which is D of V, or sometimes D of L, depending on your what you feel like writing, be the space of Z in VR, such that Z is a negative or positive, sorry, positive, oriented two-plane. Of course, as you all know, this is also can be identified with the quadric, an open subset of a quadric, which in VC, which I won't write down since that's the familiar part of the territory probably here. So this is a bounded, this is isomorphic to a bounded symmetric domain of type 4, as we've seen so many times. Now I'm going to let gamma be a subgroup of finite index in gamma L. So gamma L is just SO of L, the isometry group of this lattice. and so gamma L is S L of L, and gamma is a subgroup of finite index. It might, for example, be the subgroup which acts trivially on the discriminant space, which appeared in several talks already. And we'll let M gamma be the manifold we get by modding out D. Now, of course, everybody knows it may not be a manifold. There can be elliptic fixed points, et cetera, but I'm just going to ignore all such subtleties in the interest of finishing the talk in approximately the allotted time. So, for example, if you're very fastidious, you might want to take gamma small enough so that there are no fixed points, so you really get a manifold and so on. Of course, the dimension here, the complex dimension of D, is equal to N. And so this is a complex N-manifold or a quasi-projective variety, a la Bailey-Borel, of dimension N. Okay. Now, let's also, while we're at it, introduce the group of the G-spin group of V. So this group has the nice property that surjects onto SO of V and acts on the space V. There's a surjective map to SO of V, whereas if I took spin, then I would only hit the spinner norm one part. So let's let this be G. And so now what I'm interested in is the cohomology of these spaces a priori. But more precisely, we could just be interested in the cohomology, in which case you could do GK cohomology and representation theory and so on. Or you might actually be interested in algebraic cycles in these things. They're quasi-projective varieties. And so, in fact, Milson and I were thinking about cohomology, and we did SOPQ and UPQ and SPPQ and so forth. But in any case, when you boil it down to this case here and think about algebraic cycles, this is the case of interest. So this is where the special cycles come into play. And so let me give you the definition of the special cycles. So if I take an X in my lattice such that its inner product is negative, I hope I get all the signs right here, I let dx be the set of all z such that z is perpendicular to x. Okay? So I just take the orthogonal complement to this line. Let me draw the wonderful high-tech graphic picture. There's D. It's more symmetric than that. Sorry, I flinched. And anyway, dx, now we have a negative vector, and now you take this dx, which is all the things which are perp to that. So this has codimension 1, since after all, it's isomorphic to the D of the space Vx, which is all the orthogonal complement, or let's put it x perp, which has signature 2n minus 1. The space X perp has signature 2n minus 1 because this is a negative line. And so this thing is isomorphic, is simply equal to that. And so that gives you the dimension. So the codimension is 1. Codimension equals 1. And we can mod this out by the stabilizer of our X in the group gamma. And obviously I get a map, since dx is sitting inside of D, I get a map from here to here. Okay? Now this map is generically one-to-one, although it might be that we get this kind of a picture where there's some extra identifications that take place because of the fact that some elements of gamma make identifications that aren't made already by gamma x. But we won't worry about that for the moment. So in any case, I'm going to let zx be this, which I'm viewing as a divisor, okay, on m gamma. And I'll call this a special divisor, since we're not dealing with Riemann surfaces usually, that won't conflict with other uses of that term. So this is a special divisor, but since we're interested in theta functions and also in a little bit more, as you'll see in a moment, modular generating functions, we want to take collections of these in a suitable way. Now notice that this divisor depends only on the gamma orbit of X. All right? Because obviously if I mod out, once I pass to this quotient, I can just transport structure and I move X and gamma X around. So it depends only on the gamma orbit. And so it's really quite natural to do the following thing. Let's let L of T be the set of all X in my lattice such that XX is equal to minus T. I'm taking T, a positive integer. I take all the lattice vectors of length minus t. I haven't changed the sign yet. I will later. And so all these lattice vectors are lattice vectors that you could be using to make zx. And then we make z of t be the sum on x in L of t. Well, let's write it correctly. L of t mod gamma. So obviously, I don't want to, there's no reason to take a vector twice. I mean, two vectors in the same orbit define exactly the same divisor. So I just take the ones that could a priori define different divisors. And we let this be, and this is a finite sum. This is old-fashioned reduction theory a la Siegel. So this is a finite sum. And so this is a divisor on, this is a divisor, a special divisor on M gamma. Okay, now there's no reason to stop here in the sense that I can jazz it up a little bit. Namely, I can take a collection, which I'm writing X bold or X underline, X1 through XR, for any R between 1 and N. I can take an R-tuple of vectors. And of course, an R-tuple of vectors has a matrix of inner products. Okay. Well, of course, before I take the matrix, let's just do an R-tuple. This is an R, well, let's take the matrix of inner products. So this is, by definition, the Gram matrix, that some people like to call it, of this collection of vectors. It's just the XI, XJ, inner products. So this is in sim R of Z. You can tell I'm from south because of my strange R's, or strange Z's. But notice, by the way, I didn't mention it up there, but of course I wanted the quadratic form to be integral on L, so the dual lattice, I mentioned it already here. So. And that was implicit in what I'm saying. So this matrix of inner products is integral. Okay. So I get this matrix of inner products, and we're going to assume, so take a collection such that, and the condition is that this thing is, I'm taking this to be positive definite, this matrix of inner products of these vectors. All right. In that case, we get a cycle, z un, x, x underline, x bold, to be just in, by the same formulas, except with underlines. And the same meaning, namely dx underline is just the negative two planes which are perpendicular to all the given vectors. Well, yeah, let me change the sign here. Okay? Yeah. Okay, just as I did for t. Okay, so now this guy here has codimension r. Because if you look on the symmetric space, each time I take, after all, what does this dx look like? It's just a quotient of dx. And dx is just the same space except for x underline perp. Right? X underline perp, which has signature n, 2n minus r, since I've thrown away a negative r plane, the span of the x's. Okay, so that's what it is. It looks like... So the beauty of these varieties, as has been noted by many, many people over many, many years, is that they contain many sub-varieties of the same nature of all codimensions. So they're extremely beautiful varieties in that sense. They have a very rich supply of very natural cycles, which we're now calling special cycles. But the specialness also has to do with this particular way of defining them and collecting them. Anyway, this guy here, if I take an R-tuple with these properties, this will have codimension R. And, of course, if we take... an element of sim r z positive definite, so if I take a positive definite symmetric matrix of size r, I can define zt in exactly the same way. In fact, let me be lazy, drive people crazy. Here we go. Okay. So we just take, we define zt or lt to be the set of all r tuples whose matrix of inner products is minus t, or minus it is equal to t. Okay, this is the matrix of inner products we just discussed. And t was a given positive definite guy. So I take all frames inside my lattice, which are isometric to minus t. I sum modulo gamma. Again, this sum is finite. And I get, this will now be a special cycle on this guy of codimension r. Okay, so these are the special cycles. Pretty natural definition. And now the next thing we'd like to do with these special cycles is to consider their cohomology classes. I'm on page 2. Let's see. Do you think I get to page 32? All right. Anyway, these are the special cycles. And so now what we'd like to do is we'd like to consider their cohomology classes. So if I look at a special cycle in general, so let me start with just the case R equals 1. So this guy is in H2 of M gamma, and I'm just going to take complex coefficients to not have to worry about what the right twist is, et cetera, et cetera. You can be much more careful, of course. This is just a cohomology class, and this thing, remember, this is only quasi-projective, so I just take the usual cohomology of this manifold, which vanishes up high because it can be retracted away from the cusps a little bit, et cetera, in general. Okay, so there's classes in H2 for any of these guys, and what we're interested in is forming a generating function for these things. So that's here someplace, right. So what we're going to look at is this. We're going to look at the sum over T in Z greater than 0 of this cohomology class attached to T times Q to the T. We just make a formal generating series like this. Okay. And now we'll make a name for it. Let's put this over here. V1 of tau. Well, I haven't introduced tau yet, but of course tau will be U plus IV in the upper half plane, and Q will be e to the 2 pi I tau. Now, you can do that before or after you make the generating series, as you prefer. Now, this thing might try to be the power series of actually be an analytic function on the upper half plane, and it turns out it is. And so, it turns out now we should add one more class to this thing. Okay? Let me explain that very briefly here. Remember that the D is sitting inside, can be viewed as sitting inside of the projective space on VC. It's an open subset of a quadric inside this projective space. That's the other model for this guy. And on here we have the bundle. I'm trying not to write in the shadows, which always drove me crazy when I was sitting in the back of the room, but sorry, here it goes. We have the bundle, the tautological line bundle on here, which we can pull back to a bundle on D, since it's an open subset of the quadric. But this bundle is invariant under the action of the group gamma, because it is, and so it descends to a natural bundle on here, which we call L, and I'm going to let, say, omega be the Kähler class giving the first Chern class of L. Okay? So that's an extra, that's a hyperplane section class, if you like. Okay? And so this will be, by definition, omega, or C1L, whatever you like. So that's the definition of the constant term of this generating series. Okay, and now the theorem I've proved with Nilsson is that this V1 of tau is an elliptic modular form of weight n over 2 plus 1 valued in H2 of M gamma. So it's a vector valued modular form in the sense it's valued in this finite dimensional cohomology group, and modular form of, I assume this is familiar, the weight depends on the dimensions here, the N2, and the level of this form. This is just like a classical theta function. If you had a positive definite lattice L with a discriminant group like this, you could look in any of the classical books and determine what the level of a corresponding theta function would be, and that's how that same formula applies here. Okay. So this is the theorem we proved. And this is some kind of a generalization of the theorem of Herzebruch and Zagier, except that Herzebruch and Zagier looked at Hilbert modular cases, which were quasi-projective, but then they were more careful about the cusps than I've been here. And so this doesn't actually include Herzebruch-Zagier as a special case, because they're looking at intersection cohomology of the Bailey-Borel or whatever you like. In any case, recently, Nilsson, together with a former student of mine, Jens Funke, have generalized this theory to take care of the non-compactness more carefully. In other words, they're going to look at cohomology, but with maybe some weight filtration or something, maybe intersection cohomology and so on. And they were able to actually prove a theorem along the same lines, which covers Herzebruch-Zagier. So they can actually recover Herzebruch-Zagier from this machinery, although it's not covered by this theorem. Okay, so now let's try R equals 2. So here, what we can do is we can form a similar series. So we can form the sum over t greater than 0. I'm just not writing the integrality, et cetera, here. Let's say r greater than 1, or general r. I don't want 2. Let's take general r. I take this sum. I take the cohomology class of this guy times q to the t. I can make this formal sum in a similar way. Now, of course, here, this guy is now in H2R of M gamma, because it's a codimension R cycle. And this is simply the corresponding cohomology class. And two things now have to be done before I can define phi R of t of tau. Well, here I really was formal. I said Q to the T, where that was just a total symbol. What do I mean by Q to the T, and what is tau? Right? So here what's going to happen is that tau will be U plus IV, but now it's going to be in the Siegel space of genus R. Okay, so these are the usual R by R symmetric real matrices with V positive, okay, the usual Siegel upper half plane. And Q is replaced by Q to the trace of tau. But what we really want is to define Q to the T, which clearly is not yet defined, in spite of what I wrote here. And Q to the T is by definition E to the 2 pi I, the trace of T times tau. Notice that these are both R by R symmetric matrices. There's a nice bilinear pairing on such things given by the trace. I can take the trace and exponentiate with the 2 pi I as usual, and that's Q to the T. So this is what you would have for the Fourier expansion of a Siegel modular form, which is where we're headed. And so what's problematic here at the moment is the fact that I still have, you noticed in this case, in order to get this theorem and the modularity of this generating series, which formally was just that bit, I had to add in this constant term. But now for a Siegel modular form of genus R, this is a much more elaborate problem, because there isn't just a class Z0 to be added, but I have to add in classes for all the semi-definite, the positive semi-definite integral matrices whose rank is between, who's less than R. Okay, so there's a big series of stuff here that I need to add in. Now let me leave a little room and I'll tell you how to do it. So here we take, so this is, let's say, determinant of T is equal to 0. Okay, this is the singular part, and this is the 0 term. Okay, this is T equals 0. Okay, and so here's how you do it, very quickly. You go back to the original setup, and you look at this definition of Z of X. Now you see if XX was equal to T with a minus sign, where T is has rank less than R, it's T is greater than or equal to 0, but determinant of T is equal to 0, what does that mean? What that means is that the X's span a subspace of dimension, well, on which the quadratic form is degenerate. Okay? So we could still define dx to be exactly the things which are perpendicular to these vectors. And now it's simply going to have the wrong codimension because the rank is smaller. Now notice, by the way, that if this space has any isotropy, in other words, if there's an isotropic line in here, this is empty because you're never going to have a negative two-plane perpendicular to an isotropic line. This can't happen. So if T has any isotropy, then this is empty, and we set it equal to 0. Otherwise, what's true is that these vectors span a negative definite rank T plane. Okay? And so this thing here has codimension. Codimension is equal to the rank of T, or the rank of XX. Okay? So in other words, this guy here, the codimension doesn't drop as much as you expect. So we define a cycle which I call ZX naive, which means you just proceed as before. Take all the frames with a given matrix of inner products T modulo gamma, and take the DXs mod ZX, and so on, same definition. If this were positive definite, naive would be the same as the old thing, but this is in the wrong codimension. And so what you do is you take the cohomology class of that guy, ZX naive, and you cup it up a suitable number of times by this Kähler class. And the suitable number of times, of course, is R minus rank of T. That's how much you have to cup it up in order to get something in the correct dimension. And that applies, for example, to t equals 0, which means that this will just be omega cr, because t equals 0, the dx is the whole space, is perpendicular to 0, and then you have to cup it up that many times, which is r. So you get a series. Notice that that specializes to this series, because there's only one similar term here. It's either 0 or not 0. And so that's phi sub r of tau. And now the theorem that I'm really quoting here is the saying here is a Siegel modular form. Change all the grammar. It's a Siegel modular form of weight n over 2 plus 1 valued in m to r. Okay? So that's the theorem. So anyway, the question is, the level is just the same as for a classical theta function. In other words, if you had a lattice and you made a Siegel theta function, you would take the dual lattice modulo lattice, and there's some integer n, which is the level in the very classical sense for such a space, and that would be the level, you know, CZ plus D, 0, and so on. Okay? So just like in the classical, for classical things. Okay? Okay, so those are the basic theorems. Now, I should mention, I'm not going to have enough time to get through everything if I spend too much time on it, so I won't write what I was planning to write about this. Of course, because we're actually constructing physical special cycles, these are actual sub-varieties of M-gamma, you can do things a lot more subtle than just take their cohomology class. So, for example, you could make analogous generating series valued in the Chow groups, where you replace omega by the hyperplane section class and associated to this line bundle, or element of pick associated to this line bundle, and you could make analogous generating series. And back in the paper in which I considered these cycles, these algebraic cycles, I speculated that, in fact, this theorem probably should be true for the values in the Chow group, not just the values in cohomology. And what's true is that in the case r equals 1, this was what Borchardt's proved, not at all. I'm sure he was unaware of my paper where I suggested this. But in any case, Borchardt's proved that by a transcendental method, namely he constructed the relations among these divisors. Okay? So these were the things he called Hegner divisors, which I think is really not a good terminology. I think special is a better term. In any case, Borchardt's proved the Chow group version of the r equals 1 theorem, and the Chow group version of the general R theorem was proved modulo some kind of convergence assumptions by Wei Zhang, who was a student of Shao Zhang at Columbia. It was his Columbia thesis. He's since moved on to other things, but that was, so one almost knows or knows these things, the values in the Chow group. For R equals 1, you know it. For R higher than 1, there's still convergence issues, so it's still an open problem in some sense. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is to see what, if anything, this has to do with the subject of this conference. If I can find the right page here. Mm-hmm. Oh, here we go. Okay, so in order to do that, I want to specialize to the cases that arise in this conference. So what we're going to do, I think all this can go. Of course, this is where everybody in the audience already kind of can see pretty clearly what the right answer is, but I'll just do it quick so I go a little quicker. So let's let just K be H3 plus E8 minus 1 squared. Notice the minus 1 because I'm not a member of this conference. So this has signature 319. So this is the sort of standard K3 lattice. And now let's let KQ be just the usual, corresponding rational quadratic space. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose a decomposition of this guy into V prime plus V. So this is an orthogonal decomposition into two quadratic spaces, and I'm going to just assume here that this one here has signature 2n, and so of course this one here has signature 1, 19 minus n, which tells you something about what n can be. And then similarly, we can look at the lattice, so we can look at K intersect K V prime and K intersect V. I'm going to call this one L, and I'm going to call this one L prime. Notice that they're both primitive in this whole lattice by construction. But of course, their direct sum need not equal K. There's some indices as usual. And the signature of L is equal to 2N. also by construction. And so we're precisely in the situation that I started with. Of course, n has to lie in a suitable range here. Okay. 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 So now, of course, I'm just going to take an L prime polarized K3 surfaces. Okay, that's what I'll be interested in now. The point is, of course, that if I have a marked K3 surface, X with U, well, what I mean by a K3 polarized surface, I won't write down everything carefully. You can correct me, of course, in many ways. But anyway, if I have a K3 surface, I'm assuming I have a marking, so I'm choosing an isomorphism of H2 of X with this lattice K, and a quadratic, I'm in a isometry of these two things, so that's my marking. And I'm going to let lambda be simply a map from L prime into pick X, such that if I compose lambda with U, I get the given embedding of L prime into K. All right? So I've got this L prime floating around here. I choose an embed. I suppose as part of my data that I'm given an isometry. This is an isometric embedding, right? So it's embedding for, as quadratic spaces, not isometric. I mean, okay. So it's embedding of quadratic spaces, such that when I compose this with the marking, of course, this is sitting inside of here. When I compose this with the marking, I get the given embedding. Okay, so that's what I mean. And then, to get the moduli space, we simply remove the marking in the usual way, but of course, I'm only going to be acting in some sense on the perp to L, because the L prime is rigidly fixed here. Okay, so what happens is that if we let, we get that M gamma is the moduli space. Okay, so this is where the gamma, in for the particular way I've set it up at the moment, will be precisely the set of all isometries of L which act trivially on L check modulo L, because that's exactly the way in which these two lattices are fused in order to make K. Right? All right. So that gives us a modular interpretation of M gamma in this range. Okay. So now, where are we? Okay. Now, from this point of view, since I've already introduced these groups and so on and so forth, I just want to mention, this might be valuable to students or people like me who are sitting in the back a long time. Of course, the experts know this perfectly well. Notice that I've chosen some n here and so on and so forth. So the point is that what we're really doing here is we have some fixed Picard number. I mean, there's the Picard, the generic Picard number will be this, the 20 minus n, okay, the part that this lambda prime, that the L prime that we're fixing, okay? And so here's a little chart. So 0, 20, 1, 19, 2, 18, and so on, 3, 17, 4, 16. That covers pretty much what we've seen examples of at the one end of the table, and then at the other end, I won't write everything. At the other end of the table, of course, we get here 1. Now, the point I want to make here is just this group G, although I'm going to write SO as opposed to spin. See, we're going to be getting Shimura varieties because of the first construction I gave as opposed to the second construction. So just to see where they fit in, if I take this, the group G is in some sense U1 or O2, SO2. And this is the CM theory, CM points. These are just elliptic curves with complex multiplication, essentially. At the next, these will be Shimura curves, so here I'm going to look at SO21, or 1-2, let's be, all right, I promise. I won't change the sign yet, SO12, so here we're getting Shimura curves, et cetera. So people know this very well, but anyway, 2-2 here, I don't have to worry about the sign. Here I have to worry about the sign again. Actually, I did have to, yeah, no, okay, 1-2-3. And except here, I did have to worry about the sign. It was correct, 2-1, sorry. Okay. Anyway, I get Shimura curves. These are Hilbert modular surfaces and their twisted versions. I'm going to talk about this case in quite a bit in a few moments. But, okay, this is Siegel modular, because this is accidentally SP2R, this group, up to some coverings and so on. Here, what you get is, well, okay, it's going to be SO24. This was the case that where things worked out in beautiful detail this morning. But this is secretly the group U22, or SU22, so it's actually a unitary group, which is also well known to the experts. This occurs more naturally for these K3, or the cubic surface moduli game. That's why you get these relations. And then finally, at this far end, here we're just getting polarized K3, so there's nothing special at all about this case. These are just polarized K3s, where, of course, now there's a D, the degree, or 2N. Okay, so this is just to organize things. But you see, these will all be, these moduli spaces will all be of the type that I've just been discussing. And the one comment that I did want to make, which I think might be of interest, of course, here my lattices are automatically primitive because of the fact that I got them by intersecting my my K3 lattice with these rational subspaces, taking the full intersections. But if we just look at the spaces V that are allowed to occur in this business, so which quadratic space, rational quadratic space, I'm allowed to get, so if, what was the range, if N is less than or equal to 17, any V of signature 2N can occur. Okay? In other words, you can take any quadratic space of signature 2N, as long as N is less than or equal to 17, and make this construction. Okay? You'll get some lattice L, et cetera, et cetera. So in some sense, now if you're not fastidious about what L you get, whether it's exactly the intersection or whether it differs from that by some marking, congruent subgroup, level structure, et cetera, then you can get any L. All right, so that's just the comment I want to make, that in some sense, at least if you stay away from the extreme cases, any quadratic space V can occur. And that just comes from element Sayre's book, as we saw before. Okay, so now the next thing I want to mention, now that I've explained how these spaces here are related to K3 surfaces, is I want to explain how the special cycles are related to K3 surfaces. I wrote this on the wrong blackboard, oh well. So now, the question is that now that we have this M gamma interpreted as a moduli space for a certain type of K3 surfaces with equipment, M gamma, we want to figure out what is the meaning of this ZT sitting inside. Okay, but if you think about it, after all, if I have an element X in my lattice L, if we look back in the K3 situation, what I'm really doing is I'm adding an extra class in PIC, which is perpendicular to the given classes. Okay, and so what you can derive quite easily is the fact that let's fix this matrix T, and this gives me a quadratic space, which I'll call N. So this is now a quadratic lattice. I'm choosing the matrix T, the given matrix T, to define a quadratic form on Z to the R, or a bilinear form. Let's use the whatever. So I have an N, and so now Z of T is exactly the locus of objects of the form X lambda J. So this X lambda, I didn't say it up here, but I'm going to eliminate the marking, and that's why I get this moduli space. So it's the X lambdas, right? Here I eliminated the marking. Okay? So this is the moduli space of X lambdas, and now I get an X lambda J, where J is a map from N to pic of X, such that, well, it's an isometric map. And for any marking, I have to further put this in H2, if I had a marking, this N, well, actually I can do it more intrinsically. I just want that N, J of N, is perpendicular to lambda of L prime. Okay? So I have a map from this N, the space, into PIC, such that its image is perp to the given stuff. That's the cycle. So all you're doing is you're imposing, you're looking at the locus where there are some additional classes in PIC that have been imposed. Okay? So that's this locus. So now, and of course here, how do you get back the X, if you like? The point is that if I had, this is isomorphic to this, so here I have the standard basis vectors, and under this map, I end up inside of L because of this condition, perp condition, and the XI will be the image of EI. Okay? So these are my extra classes. Okay, so that's a modular interpretation of this guy here. And in the case where R equals 1, Chuck kindly pointed out to me that these are well known in the literature. There's a nice paper of Pandurapandi in which he these things are called explained to be the Noether Lefschetz loci, these VPs. Okay, so we have some family of K3 surfaces where the generic Picard number is some amount given by this lattice polarization, and these are exactly the loci where you have one additional class whose dot product with itself is T or minus T, and which is perp to the given classes. Okay. So the question is, so this gives a modular interpretation of these cycles, but now we have these theorems here which describe these things in terms of cohomology classes. And so the question is, what does that buy you? And so here's a little bit of an answer to that. Okay, it's on the other page here. Okay, so what we're going to do is this. So these are, you might view this as applications. So this is a translation and as applications of these theorems, what do you get? Okay, so here's sort of a couple of examples of what it says about K3s or about these moduli spaces, et cetera. Let's suppose that I have a family of K3 surfaces which are L prime polarized over, this say is a projective curve. And associated with that, if I call this pi, there'll be a map, if we ignore any kind of issues about coarse moduli spaces versus fine moduli spaces, which I'm certainly going to do here, there'll be a map from here into M gamma associated with that family. Okay? Maybe just pull back the universal family. Okay. Now, the fact that I said this is a projective curve means I get a cohomology class. Now, the codimension here is, it depends on what my n is and so on. So I guess this is 2n minus 2r of m. Okay? I get a cohomology class here because the codimension is n minus 1. Sorry. Okay? So I'll get a cohomology class there, and I put C for compactly supported because it's a projective curve. In other words, the caveat that I made in our theorem, with the theorem with Milson, that I was assuming, I'm just taking the absolute cohomology, means I can pair it with this curve. Or, if you like, the point is that the differential form representing this series may blow up badly at the boundary, I don't know, but if I'm going to integrate it over a compact curve, it's no issue. And so I can compute the intersection number of this curve with this generating series. Let's do it in the other order. C, T1 tau. This makes sense. This is valued in H2 of X of M gamma. Okay? And this is going to be a numerical series. Now, if we look at what the first term is, it's omega. So the first term is just going to be the volume of C with respect to omega, because I'm taking the degree as well. I mean, this is now in the top degree, but I just take its image under the degree map. In other words, viewed as differential forms, I integrate it over the whole manifold. So what will happen here is I'll get, when I take this inner product, what I'm going to get is, here is this volume, and now the other terms I'm going to get will be, let me just be optimistic, it's the number of points, x, z, lambda, z, j. Here we have j dot j is minus t, j with lambda is 0, j dot lambda of L prime is 0, in the curve, in the family, times q to the t. Because after all, the intersection number of zt with c, I mean, these are now actual cycles of the appropriate dimensions, and I'm assuming, let's say, that the curve is generically, I mean, that the generic Picard number is the same as that of the whole family here, okay? When I say this family, I didn't write it down, but I mean that. So that, in fact, C will not fall into any one of these loci. This one? All I'm saying is that this is an element of this particular type of family there. In other words, I have a, this is my extra class coming from the fact that I'm in ZT. Remember, in ZT, I have this extra class J, in addition to the things coming from lambda. So here I'm just saying I have an extra class. J dot J is minus T, and J is perp to the given classes. Yeah, this is a number. Yeah. So the point is that inside of my big moduli space, I have this ZT, which is this locus where I have an extra class imposed, and I have a curve, a compact curve, C, which doesn't fall in there. So it's going to cross this guy in a finite number of points. The fact that it doesn't fall in there, I'm just saying that the generic Picard rank is the same as the Picard rank of the whole surface, of the whole variety here. So at a generic point, this guy is not lying on one of these things because the Picard number goes up when you're on here. It goes up by at least one. Okay? And so if generically this has the same Picard number, then generically this doesn't meet, it doesn't lie in any of, its generic point doesn't lie in any of these divisors, so the intersections are just finite number of points with multiplicities, blah, blah, blah. I mean, tangencies, who knows, but whatever. In any case, what's true is that these numbers here are sometimes called the Noether-Lefschetz numbers for this vibration. In other words, you have this guy here, and you can look with generic Picard rank equal to the appropriate thing, right? And you can count the number of points where the Picard number jumps in the family, and those numbers, the number of jump points, where I'm counting the number of different ways it could jump. Notice that if there are two different J's at some point, I count it twice. Okay, so there's multiplicities and stack aspects, who knows what else. But in any case, these are the Fourier coefficients of a modular form of weight, elliptic modular form of weight, n over 2 plus 1. Okay, so that's an interesting fact, and this was used apparently by the physicists to constrain these Noether-Lefschetz numbers. That was the comment that Pandurapandi made, that this makes lots of constraints on these numbers because they are the Fourier coefficients of a modular form. But now, we don't have to stop there. Okay. The level is the same as the level of the original form, and so it's just given by L. So it would be wonderful to work out examples, and no one's done it. Okay. So in other words, this is what I said, there are some things that come out of both sides of this. There are things I should work on. There are things that maybe people would be interested in working on. This is a general theorem, and the proof is very general, as you see. No assumptions made, but now you can go to your favorite compact family like this and say, what do I get? Okay. So now the next thing I'm going to do, here we took R equals 1. I'm erasing, of course, what I'm speaking about. But here I just explained to you that these special cycles for any R could be interpreted as imposing extra classes, perhaps a collection of them, R of them, where here I'm only imposing one in the application I made. So let me do another example, which is kind of interesting. Again, it's supposed to be just a provocation. Additional work on this subject. And that is, well, we just do the same thing, except now I suppose that I have a surface. Oops. And this is a projective surface. Okay. So I suppose I have a family with a projective surface. And now what I could do, of course, the corresponding, there's an I pi from S into this moduli space. Again, because I said it's a projective surface, this will give me a class in H, 2n minus 4, C of m gamma, the class of associated to this this family. Gives me a cohomology class in here. And now what I can do is I can do the obvious same thing, except with this V2 guy here. And so what you'll get is this. So we're now going to get a sum. Now here I'm going to take T greater than 0. And here what I'm going to get is a generalized Noether-Lefschetz number. Namely, generically, what should happen is if I impose a pair of additional elements in PIC with a fixed inner product, in other words, the 2x2 matrix is fixed and they're perp to the given things, generically, that will, since I'm going to assume that generically here this surface has the same Picard number as this, generically, that should be a finite set of points. And you can count them, and we could call that a generalized Noether-Lefschetz number, and put that in front of Q to the T. And now you get some more stuff in here. Here what you're going to get is some kind of mixture, or you get some sort of volumes of the curves. In other words, anyway, I won't do the whole thing. So we get a volume of S with respect to omega, and some terms here which you can work out from the definition of the phi 2. This is, of course, I didn't say it, I should have said it, analogously I'm going to take S dot, or cup product, with phi 2 of tau, the second one of these generating series. And so this is a Siegel modular form of genus 2, and weight n over 2, n over 2 plus 1, and some level that you can calculate. And these generalized Lefschetz numbers are the Fourier coefficients, are the non-singular coefficients, and there's some singular terms and a volume term. Okay, so again, take your favorite family of these guys and try to calculate these things. It's not been done. Okay, but let me do an example, two examples, maybe one example in the interest of saving time, where we can do it. And this will lead naturally to, in the last 5 minutes, to the last second half of the talk about the arithmetic situation. Sorry? Yeah. So I'm just supposing that I have a family so that I can get here. Now, of course, coarse moduli space fine, but you have to be a little careful, and I'm not being totally careful. So, for example, if you want to be more careful, you could always put some kind of level, some additional marking. And as you could look at the, not mark the whole homology, but look at homology moduli n times homology, and make some marking to make some coverings so that there won't be any extra automorphisms. You get rid of stacks and singularities that way if you want. Okay. Anyway, so the example I wanted to look at was the case that suppose that L has signature 2-2. See, notice that I'm talking here about the 2-2 case. All right? Let's suppose L has signature 2-2 and is anisotropic. So I'm now taking the case N equals 2. Okay? So I take my original lattice to be an anisotropic quadratic lattice of signature 2-2, then I get this situation. Then M itself is a projective variety with a Stanley of K3 surfaces. So it's just what it was. Okay? And in that case, this has weight 2, Siegel genus 2, and I claim we actually know what it is. Okay? Well, what are we really doing here? What we're doing is we're taking this guy and just taking its degree. Right? That's all we're doing. I'm not really taking... I mean, that this really means evaluation of this top degree form on the whole space itself. Okay? So what you'll get, if you look up there, is you'll get the volume of M gamma now with respect to omega, plus some intermediate things. These will be the volumes of these curves, ZT, where rank T equals 1, with respect to omega. This should be omega squared here because it was a squared up there. But with respect to just omega this time, times Q to the T, plus a sum. And now at the top end, what you're going to get is the degree of Z of T times Q to the T, where Z of T now is a zero cycle. Its codimension is 2. And so it's simply a zero cycle, so these are just a collection of points, and degree is you count them. Okay? So this is a Siegel modular form of genus 2, right, associated with this family. But the theorem that you can prove here, using the Siegel-Bay formula, behind all this stuff is lurking the theory of theta functions, is that this is actually an Eisenstein series evaluated at a certain point attached to L. So this is some S equals S0 equals a half. And so this is an Eisenstein series attached to L. So we know what modular form it is, specifically. Okay. So I guess I have about 5 minutes left. Is that right? Okay. All right. Well, I don't want to rush too much, but I don't want to linger too much. And one option is to write down how this Eisenstein series is defined. I mean, not in detail, but just what do I mean by Eisenstein series? And the other is to skip it. Do I have a vote? Which has already taken up more time than it would have taken to write it down. Skip it? Skip it. Okay. The organizers said skip it, but okay. Okay. So now let me just go quickly to the arithmetic situation. We'll try to see what's going to happen. Okay. And I should say that in some sense, the motivation for the arithmetic situation is this identity here. So I can also write this as the degree of this guy is equal to this Eisenstein series. Okay. Okay. So now let's go to the arithmetic situation. Unfortunately, there isn't time to go through Kuga-Sasaki, et cetera, in detail now. Probably just as well. But let's continue to look at this particular family that I've already introduced here. Okay. Now, attached to this family, so I have this M gamma here. If I make the Kuga-Sasaki abelian varieties, so I've already got this family of K3 surfaces over this guy. This is my S. So this is just the family of K3 surfaces we just discussed. But I can always pass through the Kuga-Sasaki abelian varieties fiber by fiber. In other words, I can take this abelian scheme and make the Kuga-Sasaki variety out of it. This is all complex analytic. You don't have to worry about anything. And so what will be true now is that these Kuga-Sasaki abelian varieties, so there'll be an A attached to X, which will have the dimension equal 2 to, well, of course, what you're going to do is you're going to take the Clifford algebra of this quadratic space, which has dimension 2 to the 4th, okay? So this is 2 cubed now, because this is the rational dim Q of this Clifford algebra is 2 to the 4th, and so I'll get a family of 8-dimensional abelian varieties naturally living over this guy, so I'm going to call this A here. Okay. And these abelian varieties are constructed by taking the Clifford algebra over R and dividing out by the integral Clifford algebra, putting some suitable complex structure, et cetera, on here. So these guys are gotten by putting some suitable complex structure on that fixed real torus of this dimension. These are the Clifford algebras. And now what happens is that you always get a map, I'm going to let OC be equal to CL, but viewed as an algebra, into the endomorphisms of such an abelian variety. Okay? And you can look and see how this thing behaves with respect to Rosati, et cetera, et cetera. And so what you can do is you find is that this thing is not only a moduli space for K3 surfaces, but it's also a moduli space for a certain type of abelian varieties characterized by their polarization. That's the polarization that we put on here, and endomorphisms, which is the endomorphisms here. Okay? So the abelian varieties in this family are characterized by these polarization type, which is embedded here, together with this action of OC on these things. Okay? And it turns out that you can simply port that over to the arithmetic situation. In other words, instead of looking at complex abelian varieties of that dimension, you can formulate a moduli problem over spec Z. Wouldn't that be a dream? I have to invert a few things here. So there's some integer n, which might involve the level of the lattice and some various other things, like 2, for example. And so over spec with a few things inverted, you can formulate a moduli problem for abelian varieties analogous to, which will give this thing as a generic fiber. So I'm going to call the moduli space that's representable. Maybe it's a stack, but let's put a big N and make it a scheme. So there's an M, which is over here. This is the moduli space of such things. And if we take its generic fiber, or better yet, its complex fiber, we get M gamma. Okay. So the picture is that I've got this integral model. This is my M. With the generic fiber is this M gamma, maybe over Q, a canonical model, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So now the second thing is that, and here I really am running out of time, in these loci, the Z of T that I had, before they were defined by adding in an extra element of pick. But if you follow through this construction here carefully, what you find is that each time you add an element, so let's imagine I have X and AX, so if I get this extra element in pick here, it turns out that I get an extra endomorphism in endomorphisms of AX, given by right multiplication by that lattice vector, if you want to be concrete. Okay? So what happens is that these special extra classes in pick correspond to special endomorphisms. And therefore, since you can characterize these again algebraically, you can extend those things to subschemes in here. Okay, so these are integral models of the cycles defined in the same way. All right, so let me finish very quickly here. The idea now is that in this case, what we were doing is we were imposing two, generically over here, I was imposing two extra classes, J1 and J2. Okay, over here I imposed two extra classes. Okay, and so the moduli space here was a two-dimensional complex variety, the M gamma itself, and when I put these two divisors in, generically I get down to some points and I can count the points and then I add some stuff to get a moduli form. Okay, so what happens in the arithmetic situation is that this thing now has absolute dimension 3 because we've added an arithmetic dimension to it. And so what happens is you can start to impose, this is supposed to be a curly Z, you can define ZT, so this will be a divisor, but now what will happen is that when I have two of these guys, it'll intersect in some kind of points here in the generic fiber, but when I take three of them, they don't intersect in the generic fiber at all. So I can define these things, and so if T is in sim 3, sorry, 3Z, positive definite, then this ZT, this curly guy, ZT sub Q, the generic part, is empty. So I've now imposed 3. Okay, that's the analog to imposing 2 that I did in the geometric situation over there. Now I impose 3. Generically, it's empty, but it turns out that it can still have points in characteristic P. Now, these things, these points in characteristic P, in the good case, if they're zero-dimensional, these guys, these will just be spec of some little Artin ring, and if the dimension of ZT equals 0, this is curly ZT, if the dimension is 0, then it's just spec of some little Artin ring, and I can define the sort of R-Kalev degree hat of this guy to be equal just the log of the cardinality of that Artin ring. Okay. So that's the good situation. So now I'm trying to imitate what I was doing here in this previous case, which I maybe am going to have to move up. All right. Oh, I saved the board. That's great. Okay. So I'm going to take a sum, T and sim 3 of Z greater than 0, of the degree hat of ZT times Q to the T plus, okay, all right. Now, there are two lies on the blackboard. The real problem is that I said if, okay, if dimension is 0. It's usually not. This is one of these things that's very similar to what happens in the world of Gromov-Whitman invariants and so on and so forth, where there's an expected dimension for these moduli spaces. You can think of these as moduli themselves, moduli spaces. The expected dimension is 0. They're almost never zero-dimensional. So you have to attach a number to them, nonetheless. Okay? So what's true is, so let me put down the conjecture, okay, and that is that this thing is supposed to be equal to, let's put a 3 here and a 2 here. Okay. So there's an E3 tau SL, which is a weight 2 Ziegel genus 3 Eisenstein series attached to L. Okay? It's defined in some half-plane real part of S bigger than something, bigger than 3, I think, actually. Bigger than 2 here, sorry. Bigger than 2. Anyway, it's defined in some half-plane, and it has a continuation, and we can look at its value at 0. Okay? Now, that value at 0 is 0. Okay? That's one of the part of the theory. And so you can look at the next term in the expansion at 0. So you do it, and the conjecture is that these numbers, which you could, if you wanted to imitate the physics world, we can call them arithmetic higher something something anyway. They're arithmetic intersection numbers, after all, okay, are the Fourier coefficients of this derivative of an Eisenstein series. Okay, so let me finish by stating the result. This is a conjecture. So the theorem is that if the dimension of Z of T is equal to 0 and a good prime P, I didn't say what that means, it means not dividing N. Okay? P does not divide N. This is all taking place in characteristic P now. then the coefficients agree. After all, this also has some kind of a Fourier expansion, sum on t, something times q to the t. Right? So then what's true is that this degree agrees with this. This is the thing I proved with Rappaport. Who also has involved K3 surfaces a long time ago. Okay, so if the dimension of this thing is zero, we characterize when that happens, then indeed, this arithmetic intersection number is the Fourier coefficient of this derivative of this Eisenstein series. And then in a real tour de force, a student of Rappaport showed that if T is positive definite, it's also true. This is Terstiga. So anytime T is positive definite, it's actually true. And what happens is he was able to deal with the fact that, in general, this isn't a picture, but the picture is like this, and you have to attach a number to it as a derived Euler characteristic of some structure sheaves, and he was able to calculate that in this case and show that it was equal to the Fourier coefficient of this derivative. So what we now know is that this whole series here, this good part, meaning good just meaning positive definite, and, of course, away from n, there's an n that comes in, so there's some even good part that isn't taken care of because we don't know what happens away from n. And so that's the conjecture, and it's part of a huge set of such conjectures. Okay.